20,000 Leagues Under the Sea by Jules Verne. Part 1, Chapter 16, Strolling the Plains. This cell, properly speaking, was the Nautilus's arsenal and wardrobe. Hanging from its walls, a dozen diving outfits were waiting for anybody who wanted to take a stroll. After seeing these, Ned Land exhibited an obvious distaste for the idea of putting one on. "But my gallant Ned," I told him, "the forests of Crespo Island are simply underwater forests."
"Oh, great,"
put in the disappointed harpooner, watching his dreams of fresh meat fade away.
"And you, Professor Aronnax, are you going to stick yourself inside these clothes?"
"It has to be, Mr. Ned."
"Have it your way, sir," the harpooner replied, shrugging his shoulders. "But speaking for myself, I'll never get into those things unless they force me."
"No one will force you, Mr. Land," Captain Nemo said.
"And is Conseil going to risk it?"
Ned asked.
"Where Master goes, I go," Conseil replied.
At the captain's summons, two crewmen came to help us put on these heavy waterproof clothes, made from seamless India rubber and expressly designed to bear considerable pressures. They were like suits of armor that were both yielding and resistant, you might say. These clothes consisted of jacket and pants. The pants ended in bulky footwear adorned with heavy lead soles. The fabric of the jacket was reinforced with copper mail that shielded the chest, protected it from the underwater pressure, and allowed the lungs to function freely. The sleeves ended in supple gloves that didn't impede hand movements. These perfected diving suits, it was easy to see, were a far cry from such misshapen costumes as the cork breastplates, leather jumpers, seagoing tunics, barrel helmets, etc., invented and acclaimed in the 18th century. Conseil and I were soon dressed in these diving suits, as were Captain Nemo and one of his companions, a Herculean type who must have been prodigiously strong. All that remained was to encase one's head in its metal sphere. But before proceeding with this operation, I asked the captain for permission to examine the rifles set aside for us. One of the Nautilus's men presented me with a streamlined rifle whose butt was boilerplate steel, hollow inside, and of fairly large dimensions. This served as a tank for the compressed air, which a trigger-operated valve could release into the metal chamber. In a groove where the butt was heaviest, a cartridge clip held some 20 electric bullets that, by means of a spring, automatically took their places in the barrel of the rifle. As soon as one shot had been fired, another was ready to go off. "Captain Nemo," I said, "this is an ideal, easy-to-use weapon. I ask only to put it to the test. But how will we reach the bottom of the sea?"
"Right now, Professor, the Nautilus is aground in 10 meters of water, and we've only to depart."
"But how will we set out?"
"You'll see."
Captain Nemo inserted his cranium into its spherical headgear. Conseil and I did the same, but not without hearing the Canadian toss us a sarcastic, "Happy hunting!" On top, the suit ended in a collar of threaded copper, into which the metal helmet was screwed. Three holes, protected by heavy glass, allowed us to see in any direction with a simple turn of the head inside the sphere. Placed on our backs, the Roqueiro device went into operation as soon as it was in position, and for my part, I could breathe with ease. The Ruhmkorff lamp, hanging from my belt, my rifle in hand, I was ready to go forth. But in all honesty, while imprisoned in these heavy clothes and nailed to the deck by my lead soles, it was impossible for me to take a single step. But this circumstance had been foreseen, because I felt myself propelled into a little room adjoining the wardrobe. Towed in the same way, my companions went with me. I heard a door with watertight seals close after us, and we were surrounded by profound darkness. After some minutes, a sharp hissing reached my ears. I felt a distinct sensation of cold rising from my feet to my chest. Apparently, a stopcock inside the boat was letting in water from outside, which overran us and soon filled up the room. Contrived in the Nautilus's side, a second door then opened. We were lit by a subdued light. An instant later, our feet were treading the bottom of the sea. And now, how can I convey the impressions left on me by this stroll under the waters? Words are powerless to describe such wonders. When even the painter's brush can't depict the effects unique to the liquid element, how can the writer's pen hope to reproduce them? Captain Nemo walked in front, and his companion followed us a few steps to the rear. Conseil and I stayed next to each other, as if daydreaming that through our metal carapaces a little polite conversation might still be possible. Already I no longer felt the bulkiness of my clothes, footwear, and air tank, nor the weight of the heavy sphere inside which my head was rattling like an almond in its shell. Once immersed in water,
all these objects lost a part of their weight equal to the weight of the liquid they displaced, and thanks to this law of physics discovered by Archimedes, I did just fine. I was no longer an inert mass, and I had, comparatively speaking, great freedom of movement. Lighting up the seafloor even 30 feet beneath the surface of the ocean, the sun astonished me with its power. The solar rays easily crossed this aqueous mass and dispersed its dark colors. I could easily distinguish objects 100 meters away. Farther on, the bottom was tinted with fine shades of ultramarine. Then, off in the distance, it turned blue and faded in the midst of a hazy darkness. Truly, this water surrounding me was just a kind of air, denser than the atmosphere on land, but almost as transparent. Above me, I could see the calm surface of the ocean. We were walking on sand that was fine-grained and smooth, not wrinkled like beach sand, which preserves the impressions left by the waves. This dazzling carpet was a real mirror, throwing back the sun's rays with startling intensity. The outcome? An immense vista of reflections that penetrated every liquid molecule. Will anyone believe me if I assert that at this 30-foot depth I could see as if it was broad daylight? For a quarter of an hour I trod this blazing sand, which was strewn with tiny crumbs of seashell. Looming like a long reef, the Nautilus's hull disappeared little by little, but when night fell in the midst of the waters, the ship's beacon would surely facilitate our return on board, since its rays carried with perfect distinctness. This effect is difficult to understand for anyone who has never seen light beams so sharply defined on shore. There, the dust that saturates the air gives such rays the appearance of a luminous fog. But above the water, as well as underwater, shafts of electric light are transmitted with incomparable clarity. Meanwhile, we went ever onward, and these vast plains of sand seemed endless. My hands parted liquid curtains that closed again behind me, and my footprints faded swiftly under the water's pressure. Soon, scarcely blurred by their distance from us, the forms of some objects took shape before my eyes. I recognized the lower slopes of some magnificent rocks, carpeted by the finest zoophyte specimens, and right off, I was struck by an effect unique to this medium. By then it was 10 o'clock in the morning. The sun's rays hit the surface of the waves at a fairly oblique angle, decomposing by refraction, as though passing through a prism, and when this light came in contact with flowers, rocks, buds, seashells, and polyps, the edges of these objects were shaded with all 7 hues of the solar spectrum. This riot of rainbow tints was a wonder, a feast for the eyes, a genuine kaleidoscope of red, green, yellow, orange, violet, indigo, and blue, in short, the whole palette of a color-happy painter. If only I had been able to share with Conseil the intense sensations rising in my brain, competing with him in exclamations of wonderment. If only I had known, like Captain Nemo and his companion, how to exchange thoughts by means of prearranged signals. So, for lack of anything better, I talked to myself. I declaimed inside this copper box that topped my head, spending more air on empty words than was perhaps advisable. Conseil, like me, had stopped before this splendid sight. Obviously, in the presence of these zoophyte and mollusk specimens, the fine lad was classifying his head off. Polyps and echinoderms abounded on the seafloor. Various Isis coral, Cornularian coral living in isolation, tufts of virginal genus Oculina, formerly known by the name white coral, prickly fungus coral in the shape of mushrooms, sea anemone holding on by their muscular discs, providing a literal flower bed adorned by jellyfish from the genus Porpita, wearing collars of azure tentacles, and starfish that spangled the sand, including vein-like feather stars from the genus Asterophyton that were like fine lace embroidered by the hands of water nymphs, their festoons swaying to the faint undulations caused by our walking. It filled me with real chagrin to crush underfoot the gleaming mollusk samples that littered the seafloor by the thousands, concentric comb shells, hammer shells, coquina, seashells that actually hop around, top shell snails, red helmet shells, angel wing conchs, sea hares, and so many other exhibits from this inexhaustible ocean. But we had to keep walking, and we went forward while overhead there scudded schools of Portuguese men of war that let their ultramarine tentacles drift in their wakes. Medusas whose milky white or dainty pink parasols were festooned with azure tassels and shaded us from the sun's rays, plus jellyfish of the species Pelagia panopera that, in the dark, would have strewn our path with phosphorescent glimmers. All these wonders I glimpsed in the space of a quarter of a mile, barely pausing, following Captain Nemo, whose gestures kept beckoning me onward. Soon the nature of the seafloor changed. The plains of sand were followed by a bed of that viscous slime Americans call ooze, which is composed exclusively of seashells rich in limestone or silica. Then we crossed a prairie of algae, open sea plants that the waters hadn't yet torn loose, whose vegetation grew in wild profusion. Soft to the foot, these densely textured lawns would have rivaled the most luxuriant carpets woven by the hand of man. But while this greenery was sprawling under our steps, it didn't neglect us overhead. The surface of the water was crisscrossed by a floating arbor of marine plants belonging to that superabundant algae family that numbers more than 2,000 known species. I saw long ribbons of fucus drifting above me, some globular, others tubular. Laurentia cladostephus, with the slenderest foliage. Rhodomenia palmata, resembling the fan shapes of cactus. I observed that green-colored plants kept closer to the surface of the sea, while reds occupied a medium depth, which left blacks and browns in charge of designing gardens and flower beds in the ocean's lower strata. These algae are a genuine prodigy of creation, one of the wonders of world flora. This family produces both the biggest and smallest vegetables in the world, because, just as 40,000 near-invisible buds have been counted in 1 5-square-millimeter space, so also have fucus plants been gathered that were over 500 meters long. We had been gone from the Nautilus for about an hour and a half. It was almost noon. I spotted this fact in the perpendicularity of the sun's rays, which were no longer refracted. The magic of these solar colors disappeared little by little, with emerald and sapphire shades vanishing from our surroundings altogether. We walked with steady steps that rang on the seafloor with astonishing intensity. The tiniest sounds were transmitted with a speed to which the ear is unaccustomed on shore. In fact, water is a better conductor of sound than air, and under the waves noises carry 4 times as fast. Just then, the seafloor began to slope sharply downward. The light took on a uniform hue. We reached a depth of 100 meters, by which point we were undergoing a pressure of 10 atmospheres. But my diving clothes were built along such lines that I never suffered from this pressure. I felt only a certain tightness in the joints of my fingers, and even this discomfort soon disappeared. As for the exhaustion bound to accompany a 2-hour stroll in such unfamiliar trappings, it was nil. Helped by the water, my movements were executed with startling ease. Arriving at this 300-foot depth, I still detected the sun's rays, but just barely. Their intense brilliance had been followed by a reddish twilight, a midpoint between night and day. But we could see well enough to find our way, and it still wasn't necessary to activate the Ruhmkorff device. Just then, Captain Nemo stopped. He waited until I joined him, then he pointed a finger at some dark masses outlined in the shadows a short distance away. "It's the forests of Crespo Island," I thought, and I was not mistaken. The end of Part 1, Chapter 16 of 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea by Jules Verne. Read by Rick Kishner for Let to Go on the Web at fcit.usf.edu.